Much as I enjoy disturbing snow, tonight I just need to clean off and get some sleep. I never should have tried to make it through a full day of classes. My leg's gone numb and my head is killing me. Maybe it's good that Coach Mac won't take me back on the team if I can't even manage 7 hours in a desk. He looked sad when I showed up at practice, and suspicious. He said I was on probation. I take a quick, quiet shower, and when I climb into bed, I feel every bone in my body groan happily. Crowley, I miss this bed. Even though it's dusty and lumpy with goose quills that sneak through the ticking and poke you. My bedroom at home is enormous. All the furniture at home is hundreds of years old, and I'm not allowed to hang anything up or move anything around because it's all registered with the National Trust. Every few years or so, the local paper comes in and does an article. My bed there is heavy and draped, and if you look close, you'll find 42 gargoyles carved into the trim. There used to be a step stool at the head because the bed was too tall for me to climb into by myself. This bed, at Watford, is more mine than that one ever was. I roll over onto my side, facing Snow. He's sleeping, so it doesn't matter if I stare at him, which I do, even though I know it doesn't do me any good. Snow sleeps in a knot, his legs pulled up and his fists drawn in, shoulders hunched high, head tucked low, and his hair a crush of curls on the pillowcase. What little moonlight there is catches on his tawny skin. There was no light with the numpties, just one endless night of pain and noise and blood. I'm at least half dead, I think. I mean, just normally, when I'm walking around and feeling good, I'm at least half gone. When I was in that coffin, I pushed myself closer. I let myself slip away. Just to stay sane, just to get through it. And when I felt myself slipping too far, I held on to the one thing I'm always sure of. Blue eyes. Bronze curls. The fact that Simon Snow is the most powerful magician alive. That nothing can hurt him. Not even me. That Simon Snow is alive. And I'm hopelessly in love with him. 33. Baz. The operative word there is hopeless. That was evident the moment I realized I'd be the one who was most miserable if I ever succeeded in doing Snow in. It dawned on me during our fifth year, when Snow followed me around like a dog tied to my ankle. When he wouldn't give me a single moment of solace to sort through my feelings, or try to wank them away, which I eventually tried that summer, to no avail. I wish I'd never figured it out, that I love him. It's only been torment. Sharing a room with the person you want most is like sharing a room with an open fire. He's constantly drawing you in, and you're constantly stepping too close, and you know it's not good, that there is no good, that there's absolutely nothing that can ever come of it. But you do it anyway. And then... well, then you burn. Snow says I'm obsessed with fire. I'd argue that that's an inevitable side effect of being flammable. I mean, I guess everyone's flammable, ultimately, but vampires are oily rags. We're flash paper. The cruel joke of it is that I come from a long line of fire magicians. Two long lines, the Grimms and the Pitches. I'm brilliant with fire. As long as I don't get too close. No. The cruel joke of it is that Simon Snow smells like smoke. Snow whimpers. He's plagued by nightmares. We both are. And rolls onto his back, one arm reaching for a moment before he lets it fall over his head. His ridiculous curls tumble back onto the pillow. Snow wears his hair short on the back and on the sides, but the top is a thatch of loose curls, golden brown. It's dark now, but I can still see the colour. I know his skin, too. Another shade of gold, the fairest. Snow never tans, but there are freckles on his shoulders, and moles scattered all over his back and chest, his arms and legs. 3 moles on his right cheek, 2 below his left ear, 1 over his left eye. Doesn't do me any good to know all this, but I'm not sure it makes it any worse, either. I'm not sure it could get any worse. The windows are open. Snow sleeps with them open all year long, unless I throw a snit about it. It's easier to sleep with extra blankets on my bed than to complain. I've got used to the weight of them against me. I'm tired and full. I can feel the blood sloshing around in my stomach. It's probably going to wake me up to piss. Snow moans again and tosses back onto his side. I'm home. Finally. I fall asleep. 34. Baz. Snow doesn't give a shit about waking me up. He likes to be the first person down to breakfast. Chomsky knows why. It's 6 a.m., and he's already banging around our room like a cow who accidentally wandered up here. The windows are still open, and the sunlight is pouring in. I'm fine in sunlight, that's another myth, but I don't like it. It stings a bit, especially first thing in the morning. Snow suspects, I think, and is constantly opening the curtains. I guess we used to fight more about stuff like this. And then I almost killed him, and squabbling over curtains suddenly felt ridiculous. Snow will tell you I tried to kill him in our 3rd year, with the Chimera. But I was only trying to scare him that day. I wanted to see him wet his pants and cry. Instead, he went off like an H-bomb. He also says I tried to throw him down a flight of stairs the next year. Really, we were fighting at the top of the staircase, and I got in a lucky punch that sent him flying. Then, when my Aunt Fiona asked me if I'd pushed Simon Snow down a flight of stairs, I said, "Fuck yes, I did." But the next year, 5th year, I actually did try to take Snow down. I hated him so much by 3rd term. I hated the sight of him. I hated what the sight of him did to me. When Fiona told me she'd found a way to take the mage's heir out of our way, I was more than willing to help. She gave me the pocket recorder, an ancient thing with an actual tape, and warned me not to speak when it was on. She made me swear on my mother's grave. I didn't know what I was expecting to happen. I felt like I was in a spy movie, standing by the gates and pushing the button in my pocket the moment I could see Snow start to lose his temper. Maybe I thought I was entrapping him. Maybe I didn't think it would hurt him or kill him. Maybe I didn't think anything could kill him. Then came Philippa Bloody Stainton running across the lawn to embarrass herself. She wouldn't leave Snow alone that year, even though he clearly wasn't interested. The recorder swallowed up her voice in one horrible squeak, like a mouse being sucked up in a vacuum. I hit stop as soon as I heard her, but it was too late. Simon knew I did it, but he couldn't prove anything, and no one else could either. I hadn't touched my wand. I hadn't said a word. Aunt Fiona was hardly bothered by the mistake. "Philippa Stainton? She's not one of ours, is she?" I remember handing the recorder back to my aunt, thinking of the magic she must have poured into it, wondering where she got that much magic. "Don't look so glum, Basil," Fiona said, taking it from me. "We'll get him next time." A few days later, in magic words class, Miss Possibelf assured us all that Philippa would be fine, but she never came back to Watford. I'll never forget Philippa's face when her voice ran out. I'll never forget Snow's. That's the last time I tried to hurt him. Permanently. I throw curses at Snow. I torment him. I think about killing him all the time, and someday I'll have to try. But until then, what's the point? I'm going to lose. On that day, when Snow and I actually have to fight each other. I might be immortal, maybe. I don't know whom to ask. But I'm the kind of immortal you can still cut down or light on fire. Snow is something else. When he goes off, he's more of an element than a magician. I don't think our side will ever put him out or contain him, but I know that I have to do my part. We're at war. The humdrum may have killed my mother, but the mage will drive my whole family out of magic, just to make an example of us. He's already taken our influence, drained our coffers, blackened our name. We're all just waiting for the day he takes the nuclear option. Snow is the nuclear option. With Snow tucked in his belt, the mage is omnipotent. He can make us do anything. He can make us go away. I can't let that happen. This is my world, the world of mages. I have to do my part to fight for it, even if I know I'm going to lose. Snow is standing in front of his wardrobe now, trying to find a clean shirt. He stretches one arm over his head, and I watch the muscles shifting in his shoulders. All I do is lose. I sit up and throw my covers off. Snow startles and grabs a shirt. Forget that I'm here? I ask. I stride over to my wardrobe and lay my trousers and shirt over my arm. I don't know why Snow lingers at his closet like he has big decisions to make. He wears his uniform every day, even on the weekend. When I close my wardrobe door, he's staring at me. He looks unsettled. I'm not sure what I've done to unsettle him, but I sneer anyway just to drive it home. I get dressed in the bathroom. Snow and I have never dressed in front of each other. It's an extension of our mutual paranoia. And thanks, snakes, for that. My life is painful enough. When I'm dressed and ready and back in our room, Snow is still standing near his bed, shirt on but not buttoned, tie hanging round his neck. His hair actually looks worse than it did when he woke up, like he's been tearing his hands through the curls. He freezes and looks up at me. What's wrong, Snow? Cat got your tongue? He flinches. Cat got your tongue is a wicked spell, and I used it against him twice when we were third years. Baz, he clears his throat. I am a disgrace to magic. He rolls his eyes. I spit it out, Snow. You'd think you were trying to cast a spell. Are you? Next time, use your wand. It helps. He ransacks his hair again with one hand. Could you just... There's nothing remarkable about Snow's eyes. They're a standard size and shape, a little pouchy, and his eyelashes are stubby and dark brown. His eyes aren't even a remarkable colour, just blue. Not cornflower, not navy, not shot with hazel or violet. He blinks them at me, stammering. I feel myself blushing. Crowley, that's how much blood I drank last night. I'm capable of blushing. No, I say, and pick up my books. I just couldn't. I'm out the door, down the steps. I hear Snow snarling behind me. When he comes down to breakfast, his tie is still hanging. Bunce frowns and yanks on one end. He drops his scone and wipes his hand on his trousers before tying it. He looks up at me then, but I'm already looking away. 35. Simon. Penelope wants to eat lunch out on the lawn. It's a warm day, she says, and the ground is dry, and we might not have another chance to picnic like this until spring. I think she just wants to keep me away from Baz and Agatha. They've been playing games with each other all week, taking turns, staring across the dining hall, then quickly looking away. Baz always looks at me, too, to make sure I'm watching. Everyone's still gossiping about where he's been. The most popular rumours are dark coming-of-age ceremony that left him too marked up to be in public, and Ibiza. "My mother's coming to take me into town tonight," Penny says. We're sitting against a giant, twisting yew tree, looking down at the lawn in slightly different directions. "We're going to dinner," she says. "Want to come?" "That's okay, thanks." "We could go to that place you like. My mum's buying." I shake my head. "Feels like I need to keep tabs on Baz," I say. "I still don't have a clue where he's been." Penny sighs but doesn't argue. She stares out onto the brown lawn. "I miss the visitings. They were so magical." I laugh. "You know what I mean," she says. "Aunt Beryl came back to my mum, and I missed it."
"What did she say?"
"The same thing she said last time. Stop looking for my books. There's nothing in there for the likes of you."
"Wait,
she came back to tell you not to find her books?" "She was a scholar, like Mum and Dad. She doesn't think anyone's smart enough to touch her research."
"I can't believe your relative came back just to insult you."
"Mum says she always knew Aunt Beryl would take her bad attitude to hell with her."
"Do the ghosts ever show up at the wrong place?"
"I think of them more as souls."
"Souls, then. Do they ever get lost?"
"I'm not sure."
Penny turns to face me, holding out a slice of Battenberg cake. I take it.
"I know you can confuse them," she says. "You can try to hide their target. Like, if you're worried a soul might come back and tell your secret, you can try to hide the living person who might get visited. There have even been murders. If I kill you, you can't get a visitor. Ergo, you can't hear or tell my secret."
"So the visitors can get mixed up?"
"Yeah. They just show up where they think someone is supposed to be. Like a real person would. Madame Bellamy said she'd seen her husband lurking at the back of her classroom a few times before he actually came through the veil."
"Just like I saw Baz's mum at the window." I should tell Penny what happened. I always tell Penny what happened.
"Come on,"
she says, standing and brushing dead grass off the backs of her thighs.
"We'll be late to class."
She holds her hand over the napkins and plastic wrap and spins her wrist.
"A place for everything, and everything in its place."
They disappear. "Waste of magic," I say out of habit, picking up our satchels. Penny rolls her eyes.
"I'm so tired of hearing that. We're supposed to use magic. What are we saving it for?"
"So it's there if we need it."
"I know the official answer, Simon, thanks. In America, they think that you become more powerful the more magic you use."
"Just like fossil fuels." Penny glances over at me, then snorts. "Don't look so surprised," I say. "I know about fossil fuels." Baz is in half my classes. There are only 50 kids in our year. There have been terms in the past when he and I have had every class together all day long. We usually sit as far apart as possible, but today, in elocution, Madame Bellamy has us push all the desks out of the way and work in pairs. Baz ends up right behind me. Madame Bellamy's been back in class for a while now, but she still seems like, well, like she's just seen a ghost. She keeps making us do practical work while she wanders around the room looking lost. At this point, eighth year, we're past all the basic elocution stuff. Speaking out, hitting consonants, projection, it's all nuance now. How to give spells more power by saying them with fire and intent. How pausing just before a keyword can focus a spell. Gareth's my partner today, and most days. He's terrible at elocution. He still drones his spells out like he's reading from a cue card. They work, but they land like lead balloons. If Gareth levitates something, it jerks. If he transforms something, it looks like it's happening in cheap stop-motion animation. Penelope says Gareth's painful to watch, and not just because of his ridiculous magic belt buckle. Baz says Gareth wouldn't have even got into Watford in the old days. Baz's elocution is flawless, in four languages, though I suppose I'm just taking his word on that when it comes to French and Greek and Latin. I can hear him behind me, rattling off cooling spells and warming spells one after another. I feel the change in the air on the back of my neck. "Slow down, Mr. Pitch," Madame Bellamy says. "No need to waste magic." I hear the irritation in Baz's voice as he starts shooting the spells out even faster. Sometimes it's disturbing how much Baz and Penelope have in common. I've mentioned it to her before. "And," I said, "your families both hate the mage." "My family is nothing like the Pitches," she argued. "They're speciesist and racist. Baz probably doesn't even think I should be at Watford." "Is he racist?" I ask. "Isn't he a race?" His mum looks sort of Spanish or Arabic in her painting. "Arabic is a language, Simon, and everyone is a race, and Baz is the whitest person I've ever seen." "Only because he's a vampire," I said. Damn it all. I have to tell Baz about his mum. Or I have to tell Penny about Baz's mum. Or maybe even the mage. If it wasn't the humdrum who killed Baz's mother, who was it? I can't keep a secret this big. I don't have room for it. Penny sneaks up to my room before she leaves that night with her mum. She's stupidly brave. It's the only stupid thing about her. And I swear it gets worse when we go too long between emergencies. I'm tempted to slam the door when I see that it's her. "Baz will turn you in if he catches you in our tower," I say, "and you will get suspended." She waves her hand dismissively. "He's out by the pitch, watching the team practice. Pitch on the pitch." She shoves at the door, and I stop her. "Someone else will turn you in then." "Nah, all the boys in our year are scared of me. They think I'll turn them into frogs." "Is there a spell for that?" "Yes, but it's enormously draining, and I'd have to kiss them to turn them back." I sigh and let go of the door, peeking down the stairs while Penelope slips past me into my room. "I'm just here to talk you into coming with me," she says. "Not gonna work." "Come on, Simon. My mum won't lecture me so much if you're around."
"She'll lecture me instead."
I sit down on my bed. I've got a few books spread out there, and some old documents from the library.
"Right, it's a shared burden. Hey, are you reading the magical record?"
The record is the closest thing magicians have to a newspaper. It keeps track of births and deaths, magical bonds and laws, plus minutes from every coven meeting. I snuck a few bound volumes from the early 2000s out of the library.
"Yep," I say, "I've heard it's fascinating."
"You heard that from me," she says, "and I know you weren't listening. Why are you reading the magical record?"
I look up from the books. "Have you ever heard of a magician called Nico or Nicodemus?"
"Like, in history?"
"No. I don't know. Maybe. Just anybody. Maybe a politician or someone who was on the coven, or a professor." She's leaning against my bed.
"Is this for the mage? Are you on a mission?"
"No." I shake my head. "No, I haven't even seen him. I was... It's about Baz." Penny rolls her eyes. "I was thinking about his mum," I say. "Something I heard, that maybe she had an enemy.
The Pitches have always had more enemies than friends."
"Right. Anyway, it's probably not important." Penny isn't that interested, but I've asked the question, so she tries to answer it.
"An enemy named Nico."
But then something in her coat pocket chimes. Her eyes get big, and she jabs her hand in her pocket. I feel my eyes get big, too.
"Do you have a phone?"
"Simon."
"Penelope, you can't have a mobile at Watford."
She folds her arms.
"I don't see why not."
"Because of the rules, they're a security risk." She frowns and pulls out the phone, a white iPhone, a new one.
My parents feel better if I carry it. How does that even work in here?
I ask. There are supposed to be spells. Penelope's checking her texts.
My mum magicked it. She's here now, at the gates.
She looks up.
Please come with us.
Your mum would make a terrifying supervillain.
Penny grins. Come to dinner, Simon.
I shake my head again. No, I want to look this stuff over before Baz comes back. Finally, she gives in and runs down the tower stairs like she doesn't give a fig about getting caught. I go to the window to see if I can spot Baz out on the pitch.
36. Penelope.
My mum insisted on me having a mobile after what happened with the humdrum. For a few weeks this summer, she was saying I couldn't come back to Watford at all, and my dad didn't even try to talk her down. I think maybe he felt responsible, like he should have figured the humdrum out by now. He spent the whole month of June in his lab, not even coming out to eat. Mum made his favourite biryani and left steaming plates of it outside his door. That madman, Mum kept ranting, sending children to fight the humdrum. The mage didn't send us, I tried telling her. The humdrum took us, but that just made her angrier. I thought she'd want to work out how the humdrum had done it. It's impossible to steal someone like that, to port them that far. The magic required. Even Simon doesn't have enough. But Mum refused to approach it intellectually. It made me really glad that she doesn't know the details of every other scrape Simon and I have got ourselves into. And got ourselves out of, I should add. We deserve some credit for that. Mum probably would have cooled down sooner if it weren't for the nightmares. I didn't scream when it actually happened. One minute, Simon and I were in the Wavering Wood, gaping at Baz and Agatha, me holding Simon's arm, and the next minute, we were in a clearing in Lancashire. Simon recognised it. He lived in a home there when he was a kid, near Pendle Hill. There's this big sound sculpture that looks like a tornado, and I thought at first that the noise was the humdrum. I could already feel that we were in one of his dead spots. Dad studies dead spots, so I've been to loads of them. They're the holes in the magical atmosphere that started appearing when the humdrum did. Stepping into a dead spot is like losing a sense, like opening your mouth and realising you can't make any noise. Most magicians can't handle it. They start to lose their shit immediately. But Dad told me he's never had as much magic as most magicians, so it isn't as terrifying for him to think of losing it. So Simon and I show up in this clearing, and I can feel right away it's a dead spot. But it's more than that. It's worse. There's this weird whistling on the wind, and everything's dry, so dry and hot. Maybe it's not a dead spot, I thought. Maybe it's a dying spot. Lancashire, Simon said to himself. And then the humdrum was there, and I knew it was the humdrum because he was the source of everything. Like the way you know that the sun is what makes the day bright. All the heat and dryness were coming from him, or sucking toward him. And neither of us, Simon or me, cried out or tried to run because we were too much in shock. There was the humdrum, and he looked just like Simon. Just like Simon when I first met him, 11 years old, in grotty jeans and an old T-shirt. The humdrum was even bouncing that red rubber ball that Simon never put down her first year. The kid bounced the ball at Simon, and Simon caught it. Then Simon started screaming at the humdrum, "Stop it! Stop it! Show yourself, you coward! Show yourself!" It was so hot and so dry, and it felt like the life was getting sucked out of us, sucked right up through our skin. Both of us had felt it before during the humdrum's attacks, that sandy, dry suck. We knew what he felt like. We recognised him, but we'd never seen the humdrum before. Now I wonder if that was the first time the humdrum was able to show himself. Simon was sure the humdrum was wearing his face just to taunt him. He kept howling at it to show its real face. But the humdrum just laughed, like a little kid. The way little kids laugh once they've got started and they can't stop. I can't really say why I think so or what it means, but I don't think that the humdrum appeared that way as a mean joke. I think that's his true form, that he looks like Simon. The suck was too much. I looked down at my arm, and there was yellow fluid and blood starting to seep through my pores. Simon was shouting, the humdrum was laughing. I reached out and took the ball from Simon and threw it down the hill. The humdrum stopped laughing then and immediately darted after the ball. The second he turned away from us, the sucking stopped. I fell over. Simon picked me up and threw me over his shoulder, which is pretty amazing considering I weigh as much as he does. He pushed forward like a Royal Marine, and as soon as he was out of the dead spot, he shifted me around to the front, and big bony wings burst out of his back. Sort of wings, misshapen and overly feathered with too many joints. There's no spell for that. There are no words. Simon just said, "I wish I could fly." And he made the words magic. I haven't told anyone that part. Magicians aren't genies. We don't run on wishes. If anyone knew that Simon could do that, they'd have him burnt at the stake. We were both hurt, so I tried to cast healing spells. I kept thinking that the humdrum would haul us back as soon as he found his ball. But maybe that wasn't the sort of trick he could manage twice in one day. Simon flew as far as he could with me clinging to him, stuck to him with spells and fading fast. Then I think he realized how mad we looked and landed near a town. We were going to take a train, but Simon couldn't get his wings to retract, because they weren't wings. They were bones and feathers and magic and will. This is what my nightmares are about. Hiding in a ditch along the side of the road, Simon's exhausted, and I'm crying, and I'm trying to gather the wings up and push them into his back so that we can walk into town and catch a train. The wings are falling apart in my hands. Simon's bleeding. In my nightmares, I can't remember the right spell. But I remembered it that day. It's a spell for scared children, for sweeping away practical jokes and flights of fancy. I pressed my hand into Simon's back and choked out, "Nonsense!" The wings disintegrated into clumps of dust and gore on his shoulders. Simon picked someone's pocket at the train station so he could buy tickets. We slept on the train, leaning against each other, and when we got back to Watford, it was the middle of the end-of-year ceremony, and my mum and dad were there, and they dragged me home. They almost didn't let me come back to school this autumn. They tried to talk me into staying in America. Mum and I yelled at each other, and we haven't really talked properly since. I told my parents I couldn't miss my last year. But we all knew that what I really meant was that I wouldn't let Simon come back without me. I said I'd walk back to Watford, that I'd find a way to fly. Now they make me carry a mobile phone.
37. Agatha.
Watford is a quiet place if you're not dating Simon Snow, and if you've spent so many years with Simon Snow that you never bothered making other friends. I don't have a roommate. The roommate the Crucible gave me, Philippa, got sick in our fifth year and went home. Simon said Baz did something to her. Dad said she had a sudden traumatic laryngitis. A tragedy for a magician. That would be a tragedy for anyone, I said. Normals talk too. I don't really miss Philippa. She was dead jealous that Simon liked me. And she laughed at my spell work. Plus, she always painted her nails without opening a window. I do have friends, real friends, back home, but I'm not allowed to tell them about Watford. I'm not even able to tell them. Dad spelled me mum after he caught me complaining to my best friend Minty about my wand. I just said it was a hassle carrying it everywhere. I didn't tell her it was magic.
Oh, for snake's sake, Agatha,
Dad said. My mother was livid. You have to do it, Welby. So Dad levelled his wand at me.
Ixnay on the Atford Way.
It's a serious spell. Only members of the coven are allowed to use it. But I suppose it was a serious situation. If you tell normals about magic, they all have to be tracked down and scoured. And if that's not possible, you have to move away. Now Minty, we met in primary school, that's actually her first name, isn't it, Lush? Thinks I go to a super religious boarding school that doesn't allow the internet, which is all true, as far as I'm concerned. Magic is a religion. But there's no such thing as not believing. Or only going through the motions on Easter and Christmas. Your whole life has to revolve around magic all the time. If you're born with magic, you're stuck with it. And you're stuck with other magicians. And you're stuck with wars that never end because people don't even know when they started. I don't talk like this to my parents, or to Simon and Penny. Ixnay on my ooh feelings tray. Baz is walking by himself across the courtyard. We haven't talked since he's been back. We've never really talked, I guess. Even that time in the wood. Simon burst in before we could get anywhere. And then Simon burst out again. Just when you think you're having a scene without Simon, he drops in to remind you that everyone else is a supporting character in his catastrophe. As soon as Simon and Penny disappeared that day, Baz dropped my hands. What the fuck just happened to Snow? Those were his last words to me. But he does still watch me in the dining hall. It makes Simon mental. This morning, Simon got fed up and slammed his fork down, and when I looked over at Baz, he winked. I hurry to catch up with him now. The sun is setting, and it's making his grey skin look almost warm. I know it's setting my hair on fire. Basil, I say coolly, smiling like his name's a secret. He turns his head slightly to see me.
Well, beloved?
He sounds tired. We haven't talked since you've been back, I say.
Did we talk before that?
I decide to be bold. Not as much as I'd like. He sighs.
Crowley, well, beloved. There must be a better way to get your parents' attention.
What? Nothing, he says, walking ahead. Paz, I thought you might need someone to talk to.
Nope, I'm good.
But... He stops and sighs, rubbing his eyes.
Look, Agatha, we both know that whatever you and Snow are squabbling about, you'll soon work it out and be back to your golden destiny. Don't complicate it.
But we're not. Baz has started walking again. He's limping a little. Maybe that's why he isn't playing football. I keep following him. Maybe I don't want a golden destiny, I say.
When you figure out how to sidestep destiny, let me know.
He's walking as fast as he can with his limp, and I decide not to run to keep up with him. That would look appalling. Maybe I want something more interesting, I call out.
I'm not more interesting, he shouts back, without turning his head. I'm just wrong for you. Learn the difference.
I bite down on my bottom lip and try not to cross my arms like a six-year-old. How does he know he's wrong for me? Why does everyone else think they know where I belong?
38. Baz.
Snow has been staring at me all day, for weeks now, and I'm just really not up for it. Maybe Aunt Fiona was right. I should have stayed home longer and rested up. I feel like complete shit. Like I can't get full and I can't get warm. And last night, I had some sort of attack in the catacombs. It's so fucking dark down there. And even though I can see in the dark, I felt like I was back in that stupid numpty coffin. I couldn't stay underground any longer. I caught 6 rats, banged their heads on the floor, tied their tails in a knot, then brought them back upstairs and drained them in the courtyard under the stars. May as well have sent an engraved announcement to the whole school telling them I'm a vampire. A vampire who's afraid of the dark for Crowley's sake. I threw the rat carcasses to the merwolves. They're worse than rats. I'd drain every one of them if the taste didn't stay in my mouth for weeks. Gamey and fishy. And I slept like the dead for 9 hours, and it still wasn't enough. I've been asleep on my feet since lunch, and I can't exactly go up to my room to take a nap. Snow would probably sit across from me and watch. He's been following me everywhere since I got back. He hasn't been this persistent since our 5th year. He even followed me to the boys' toilet yesterday and pretended he just needed to wash his hands. I don't have the strength for it. I feel 15 again, like I'm going to give in if he gets too close. Kiss him or bite him. The only reason that I got through that year was that I couldn't decide which of those options would finally put me out of my misery. Probably Snow himself would put me out of my misery if I tried either one. Those were my 50-year fantasies. Kisses and blood and Snow ridding the world of me. I watched the football practice this afternoon, just for an excuse to sit down, then slipped away from the team when everyone else headed for dinner. Wellbeloved catches me in the courtyard and tries to suck me into a maiden fair drama, but I haven't got time for the pain. I heard Miss Possibelf say that the mage is coming back to Watford tomorrow, and I still haven't snuck up to his office, probably because it's an idiotic idea. But if I go up there and take something, it will at least get Fiona off my back for a while. I haul myself to the Weeping Tower and skip the spiral staircase to take the staff elevator up to the very top. I walk past the door to the headmaster's rooms. When my mother was headmistress, I lived there with her. I was just a toddler. Father would come in most weekends, and we'd all go back to the house in Hampshire every summer. My mother used to let me play in her office while she worked. She'd come get me from the nursery and let me spread my Lego bricks out on her rug. When I get to the headmaster's office, the door opens easily for me. The mage never took down the wards my mother cast to let me in. I can get into his rooms, too. I snuck in once and found myself puking in his toilet. Fiona would have me inspecting his chambers every night, but I've told her that we have to save that trick until we really need it, until we can use it, and not just to leave steaming bags of shit on his bed. Furthermore, Fiona, I'm not shitting in a bag. I'll do the shitting, you knob. It can be my shit. My stomach clenches when I walk into the office. When I see my mother's desk. It's dark in here. The curtains are drawn. So I light a fire in my palm and hold it out in front of me. It terrifies my stepmother when I do this.
Basilton, don't! You're flammable!
But bringing fire is as easy for me as breathing. It hardly takes any magic. And I always feel utterly in control. I can make it twist through my fingers like a snake. Just like Natasha, my father always says. He's got more fire than a demon. Though father did draw a hard line when he caught me smoking cigarettes in the carriage house. For Crowley's sake, Baz, you are flammable. The headmaster's office looks exactly the same as it did when I played here. You'd think the mage would have thrown all my mother's things out and hung up Che Guevara posters. But he didn't. There's dust on his chair, on my mother's chair, and thick dust on the computer keyboard.
I don't think he even uses it. He's not the sitting, typing type, the mage. He's always stalking around or swinging a sword or doing something to justify his Robin Hood costume. I open his top drawer with my wand. Nothing here. Dried up office supplies. A phone charger. My mother kept tea in this drawer and mint aero bars and clove drops. I lean in to see if I can smell them. I can smell things other people can't. I can smell things no people can, because I'm not a person. The drawer smells like wood and leather. The room smells like leather and steel and the forest, like the mage himself. I open the other drawers with my hand. There aren't any booby traps. There's nothing personal at all. I'm not even sure what to take for Fiona. A book, maybe. I hold my flame up to the bookshelves and think about blowing, just setting the whole room on fire. But then I notice that the books are all out of order, obviously out of order, stacked instead of set on the shelves, some of them lying in piles on the floor. I feel like putting them back, sorting them by subject, the way my mother used to. I was always allowed to touch her books. I was allowed to read any book as long as I put it back in its place and promised to ask if something confused or frightened me. Maybe I should take advantage of the fact that the books are out of order. No one will notice if I take one. Or several. I reach for one with a dragon embossed on the spine. The dragon's mouth is open and fire spews out, forming the title, Flames and Blazes, The Art of Burning. A shaft of light widens on the shelf before me, and I jerk around, sending the book sailing onto the floor, pages flapping. Something flies out as the book hits the floor. Snow is standing in the doorway. "What are you doing here?" he demands. His blade is already out. I've seen that sword in action enough. You'd think I'd be frightened. But instead, it's reassuring. I've dealt with this, with Snow, before. I must be truly exhausted because I tell him the truth. Looking for one of my mother's books. "You're not supposed to be in here," he says, both hands on his sword. I hold my light higher and step away from the shelves. I'm not hurting anything. I just want a book. "Why?" He looks down at the book lying between us and rushes forward, abandoning his stance to beat me to it. I lean back against the shelves and swing one ankle over the other. Snow's crouching over the book. He probably thinks it's a clue, the thing that will blow my conspiracy open wide. He stands again, staring at a small piece of paper in his hand. He looks upset. "Here," he says softly, holding it out to me. Sorry. I take the paper, a photograph, and he watches me. I'm tempted to shove it in my pocket and look at it later, but curiosity gets the best of me, and I hold it up. It's me. Down in the creche, I think. Watford used to have a staff nursery and day school. It's where the vampires struck. I'm just a baby in this photo, 3 or 4 years old, wearing soft grey dungarees with bloomer bottoms and white leather boots. My skin is the shocking thing. A stark reddish gold against my white collared shirt and white socks. I'm smiling at the camera, and someone's holding my fingers. I recognize my mother's wedding ring. I recognize her thick, rough hand. And then I can remember her hand. Resting on my leg when she wanted me to be still. Holding her wand precisely in the air, slipping into a desk drawer to get a sweet and popping it into her mouth. "Your hands are scratchy," I'd say when she cupped one around my cheek. "They're fireholder hands," she'd say. "Flamethrowers." My mother's hands scuffing my cheek, tucking my hair behind my ears. My mother's hands held aloft, setting the air of the nursery on fire while a chalk-skinned monster buried his teeth in my throat.
Baz, Snow says. He's picked up the book and is holding it out to me.
I take it.
I need to tell you something, he says.
What?
Since when do Snow and I have anything to tell each other?
I need to talk to you.
I raise my chin.
Talk, then.
Not here. He sheathes his blade. We're not supposed to be here, and what I have to tell you is sort of private.
For a moment, not even a moment, a split second, I imagine him saying,
"The truth is, I'm desperately attracted to you."
And then I imagine myself spitting in his face. And then I imagine licking it off his cheek and kissing him. Because I'm disturbed. Ask anyone. I make a wish.
The flame out of my hand. Tuck the photo into the book and the book under my arm.
Lucky for us, I say. We have our own suite at the top of a turret. Private enough for you?
He nods, embarrassed, and gestures for me to walk ahead of him.
Just come on, he says.
I do. 39. Simon.
I just caught my enemy red-handed breaking into the mage's office. I could have got him expelled for this, finally.
And instead I gave him the thing he came to steal, then asked him if we could have some alone time. All because of a baby picture. But the look on Baz's face in that picture, smiling just because he was happy, with cheeks like red apples. And the look on his face when he saw it. Like someone blew a horn and all his walls crumbled. We walk back to our room, and it's awkward. We don't have any experience walking with each other, even though we're usually headed in the same direction. We keep our distance on the stairs, then move even farther away as we cross the courtyards. I keep wanting to get my sword back out. Baz has worked himself up to a full-on strop by the time we get to our room. He slams the door behind us, sets the book on his bed, then crosses his arms. Fine, Snow. We're alone. Whatever you have to say, say it. I cross my arms, too. All right. I say, just sit down, okay?
Why should I sit down?
Because you're making me uncomfortable.
Good, he says. You should be glad I'm not making you bleed.
For Christ's sake, I say.
I swear like a normal only when I'm at my wit's end.
Could you just calm down? This is important.
Baz shakes his head, exasperated, but sits at the end of his bed, frowning at me. He has these droopy dog eyes that always look like they're peeking out from under his eyelids, even when his eyes are wide open, and his lips naturally turn down at the corners. It's like his face was designed for pouting. I walk over to my book bag and pull out a notebook. I wrote down as much as I could the day after Baz's mum came to see me. I thought I was writing it all down to share with the mage. I sit on my bed, facing him, and he reluctantly shifts to sit across from me.
All right, I say. Look, I don't want to tell you this. I don't even know if I should. But it's your mum, and I don't think it's right to keep it from you.
What about my mother? His arms unfold and he leans forward, grabbing at my notebook. I whip the notebook away.
I'm telling you, okay? Just listen.
His eyes narrow.
I'm stupidly flustered. When you were gone when the veil lifted.
He guesses it immediately. His nostrils flare and his eyes go a little wild. He's so fucking smart. I don't know how I'm ever going to get the best of him.
My mother, he says.
She was looking for you. She kept coming back. Here. Where were you that she couldn't find you?
My mother came through the veil.
Yeah. She said she was called here, to our room, that this was your place. And she was pretty hacked off that you weren't here, wanted to know whether I'd hurt you.
She talked to you?
Yeah. I mean, yes. I ran my hands through my hair. She came looking for you and scared the living shit out of me, asking if I'd hurt you. And then she said that the veil was closing. I looked down at my notebook. Baz grabs it from me, scanning the pages hungrily, then hurls it back at my chest.
You write like an animal. What did she say?
She said that... My voice falters. That her killer walks. That you should find Nicodemus and bring her peace.
Bring her peace?
I don't know what more to say. His face is in agony.
But she killed the vampires, he says.
I know.
Does she mean the humdrum?
I don't know.
Tell me again.
I look back down at my notes.
Her killer walks, but Nicodemus knows. Find Nicodemus and bring her peace. Who's Nicodemus? Baz demands, fierce and imperious, just like his mother.
She didn't say.
What else? He asks. Was there anything else?
Well, she kissed me. My hand jerks up and I brush my fingertips over my forehead. She told me it was for you. To give to you. He clenches his fists at his sides.
Then what?
Then she left. I say. She came back one more time that same night. The last night before the veil fell. Baz looks like he wants to choke me. And she was different. Sadder. Like she was crying. I looked down at my notes. And I couldn't see her that time, but she said, "My son, my rosebud boy." She said that a few times, I think. And then she called me by my name and said she never would have left you. And then he said we were stars.
Who said? Nicodemus?
I guess. I don't know. Baz squeezes his fists tight and his voice comes out of him in a tight roar.
Who the fuck is Nicodemus?
I don't know, I say.
I thought you'd know.
He gets off the bed and starts prowling across the room.
My mother came back. She came back to see me, and you talked to her instead. Unbelievable.
Well, where were you? Why couldn't she find you?
I was indisposed. It's none of your business. Well, I hope your secret trip was worth it, I shout, because your mother came for you. She came, and she came, and she came, and you were off planning your hopeless rebellion. He stops pacing, then charges toward me, his hands reaching for my neck, and I'm more scared for him than I am for myself, even though I know he wants to kill me, because if he touches me, he'll be cast out, the anathema. I jump to my feet and catch his wrists. They're cold.
Baz, you don't want to hurt me, do you? He strains against my grip. He's panting with rage.
You don't want to hurt me, I say, trying to push him back.
Isn't that right?
I'm sorry. Look at me. I'm sorry.
His grey eyes focus and he steps back, snatching his arms away. We both glance around the room, waiting for the anathema to kick in. There's a knock at the door and we both jump.
Simon,
I hear Penny say. Baz arches an eyebrow, and I can practically hear him thinking, interesting. I shove past him and open the door.
Penny, what are you...
She's been crying. She starts again.
Simon.
And rushes into my arms. I slowly put my arms around her and look up at Baz, waiting for him to raise the alarm. He shakes his head, like it's all too much for him.
I'll leave you alone,
he says, sliding past us out the door. I hate to think of how he'll use this against Penelope or me. But right now I've got Penny sobbing into my shirt. Hey, I say, patting her back. I'm not good at hugging. She knows that, but she must not care right now. Hey, what's wrong? She pulls back and wipes her face on her sleeve. She's still wearing a coat.
My mum.
Her face is all crumpled. She wipes it on her sleeve again. Is she okay?
She's not hurt. Nobody's hurt. But she told me that Premal came yesterday.
Penny's talking too fast and still crying.
He came for the mage with two more of his men, and they wanted to search our house.
What? Why?
The mage sent them. Premal said it was a routine search for banned magic, but Mum said there's no such thing as a routine search, and she'd be damned to Slough before she let the mage treat her like she was an enemy of the state. And then Premal said it wasn't a request. And Mum said they could come back with an order from the coven.
Penny's shaking in my arms.
And Prem said that we're at war, and that the mage is the mage, and what did Mum have to hide anyway? Mum said that wasn't the point. The point was civil liberties and freedom and not having your 20-year-old son showing up at your house like Rolf in The Sound of Music. And I'm sure Prema was humiliated and not acting like himself, or maybe just acting more like his tosser self than usual, because he said he'd be back and that Mum had better change her mind. And Mum said that he could come back as a Nazi and a fascist, but not as her son.
Penny's voice breaks again, and she covers her face in her arms, elbowing me in the chin. I pull my head back and hold onto her shoulders. Hey, I say, I'm pretty sure this is just something that got out of hand. We'll talk to the mage. She jerks away from me.
Simon, no, you can't talk to him about this.
Pen, it's the mage. He's not going to hurt your family. He knows you're good.
She shakes her head. My mum made me promise not to tell you, Simon.
No secrets, I say, suddenly defensive. We have a pact.
I know. That's why I'm here. But you cannot tell the mage. My mother's scared. And my mother doesn't get scared.
Why didn't she just let them search the house?
Why should she?
Because, I say. If the mage is doing this, he has a reason. He doesn't just hassle people. He doesn't have time for that.
But what if they found something?
At your house? They wouldn't.
They might, she says. You know my mum? Information wants to be free. There's no such thing as a bad thought. Our library is practically as big as Watford's and better stocked. If you wanted to find something dangerous in there, I'm sure you could.
But the mage doesn't want to hurt your family.
Who does he want to hurt, Simon?
People who want to hurt us, I say. I practically shout it. People who want to hurt me. Penny folds her arms and looks at me. She's mostly stopped crying.
The mage isn't perfect. He's not always right.
No one is. But we have to trust him. He's doing his best. As soon as I say it, I feel a pound of guilt settle in my stomach. I should have told the mage about the ghost. I should have told Penny. I should have told them both before I told Baz. I could be spying for the wrong side.
I need to think about this, Penny says. It's not my secret to tell. Or yours.
All right, I agree.
All right.
A few more tears well up on her, and she shakes her head again.
I should go. I can't believe Baz hasn't come back with the house monitor yet. They probably think he's lying.
I don't think he's snitching on you.
She huffs. Of course he is. I don't care. I have bigger worries.
Stay for a bit, I say. If she stays, I'll tell her about Baz's mum.
No, we can talk about this tomorrow. I just needed to tell you.
Your family will be safe, I say. You don't have to worry about it. I promise. Penelope looks unconvinced, and I half expect her to point out how worthless my words have been so far. She just nods and tells me she'll see me at breakfast. 40. Baz.
I could watch Bunce swing for this. I didn't even think it was possible for anyone to get past the residence hall's gender barriers. Trust Bunce to find a way. She's incessantly fiendish. But I don't even care. I find my way down to the catacombs and hunt mindlessly. My mother's tomb is here. I hate to think that she might be watching me. Can souls see through the veil? Does she know I've become one of them? I wonder sometimes what would happen if she'd lived. I was the only child in the nursery who was turned that day. The vampires might have taken me with them if my mother hadn't stopped them. My father came for me as soon as he heard, and he and Fiona did everything they could to heal me, but they knew I was changed. They knew the bloodlust would manifest itself eventually. And they went on acting like nothing had happened. Crowley, they're lucky I didn't start devouring people as soon as I hit puberty. I don't think my father would ever have mentioned it, even if he'd caught me draining the maid. Basil, change into some new things for dinner. You'll upset your stepmother. Though he'd much prefer to catch me disrobing the maid. Definitely more disappointed in my queerness than my undeadness. My father never acknowledges that I'm a vampire, besides my flammability. And I know he'll never send me away because of it. But my mother? She would have killed me. She would have faced me, what I am, and done what was right. My mother would never have let a vampire into Watford. She didn't. I end my walk at the door to her tomb, at the stone in the wall that marks it. She was the youngest person ever to lead Watford, and one of three headmasters in history to die defending it. She's kept here in a place of honour, part of the school's foundation. My mother came back. She came back for me. What does it mean that she couldn't find me? Maybe ghosts can't see through coffins. Maybe she couldn't see me because I'm not fully alive. Will I get to see her when Simon finally finishes me? He will finish me. Simon will do the right thing. I stay in the catacombs until I'm done feeding, until I'm done raging, until I can't stand staring at that photograph of myself anymore, chubby, lucky bag of blood, until I'm done crying. You'd think that's something you'd lose in the change, tears. But I still piss, and I still cry. I still lose water. I don't really know how it all works, being a vampire. My family won't let me near a magical doctor, and it's not like I get colds or need vaccinations.